Comfortable stomach flu, so.
No fun. Are we ready? We are ready. House Committee on Revenue will come to order for February 10th, 2011. It is 8 o'clock officially, and we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2541. Mazin, tell us all about it.
Chair Bonhart, members of the committee, House Bill. The House Bill 2541 is the first culmination of the work that has been going on for the better part of a couple of years. And just to give you a quick synopsis of what we're looking at here, this is the work with the inheritance/estate tax, and probably these are the last times we will be calling it inheritance tax work group or work product, and we will from now on start talking more about the estate. But to go quickly with a very quick background on this for the people who haven't lived this, no pun intended with the living here. So in the past, we had federal pickup tax. Things were easy in life. The federal government would tax estates. Oregon basically tagged on to the federal credit, got its part, and then they sent it to us. Then there was a time when the federal government came to a point that they wanted to change things around, and they thought if states want to continue having their state tax, they should explicitly have it in their law. And that when things started disconnecting from the federal code. And of course, in Oregon here, we thought they probably would change their mind a little bit down the line. So what we did is we said, okay, we will continue the inheritance tax or the estate tax, but we will do it as if the federal code is still in operation. So we were one of the few states who did. Many states allowed their estate tax to elapse, extinguish, die at least. And We did not do that. We had in our code saying to figure out your taxes, you will do the same thing as you would have done before in the federal forms, and then find the credit schedule, and then you need to pay Oregon tax. In other words, you don't have a tax schedule in Oregon code. You have to go to the federal code in order to find your tax due. So there came a time when we also tried to change things within the state tax, and that was in the 2007 session when we started proposing giving a different treatment or some level of break for the natural resource properties. Natural resource properties at that time were thought as farms, forests, and fisheries. Of course, having to do some tweaks in the tax code in the Oregon side without having the tax code actually in Oregon law kind of started giving us problems, and immediately we found out that is not going to work as neatly as we thought it would. And that was the beginning of a different type of work that we started looking at in the special session or the short session of the first short session of 2008. And many in the committee remember the work that we've done. We tried to clean up a lot of that work by giving definitions, building the statues around the natural resource credit and so on. And we spent the better part of the 2008 working with this. However, it is also started showing some cracks after that. And it was as if we're trying to build a new income tax process after the federal government have changed its income tax procedures. So in a lot of ways, we started thinking that we needed to look into this in a more comprehensive way. And in the 2009 session, I think the epiphany came. And I think mainly at that time, Chair Berger was the one who championed the idea of taking this project to the Oregon Law Commission. The Oregon Law Commission has taken the mantle and ran with it, and they actually have put together an impressive number of experts and people who are with deep knowledge and practitioners and all types of different inputs that came to the table, and they started building on this project. And today you would have the contours of the first outlooks of what is becoming or quickly emerging as the outcome of all that effort. As probably you would see at the end, there are a few things that still need to be done, but I have to take it to the Oregon Law Commission with Chair Lane Shirley when I suggested that if there is things that are not completely done, if they would pass it to the committee. And his response was, it might be 4th and 40, but the Law Commission does not punt. The Law Commission will finish this project and bring it to you in the completed way. So not taking the punt. I think the Law Commission is here to go over what they have been doing for the last couple of years and build a framework that you probably would need in order to come now and take this major reform of the tax system.
Great. Thank you very much. And we have Lane Shetter and Wendy Johnson. Lane, welcome back yet again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Madam Co-Chair, Lane Shetterly, I'm an attorney in Dallas, but here before you this morning in my capacity as Chair of the Oregon Law Commission, and even more particularly Chair of the Inheritance Tax. As Mazin says, we're learning, we're weaning our way, weaning ourselves away from that. We'll call ourselves the Estate Tax Project to rewrite Oregon's current inheritance tax laws. I'm joined here by Wendy Johnson, who is Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Law Commission, and has been staffing this work group since it began back in September of 2009. Mazin gave you a good overview. Just a couple of things I would touch on just by way of background before I comment on a few specifics that we'll be bringing forward to you. First, while you have a printed bill in front of you, House Bill 2541, you really can disregard that for the purpose of today's overview. This represents work in place probably around September or so of last year when this thing we got into print. We've continued to work on it, and so what I'll give you today really is an overview, but I wouldn't try and tie it into the bill. You'll have an LC amendment that will substantially amend the bill at some point here very soon. Secondly, one of the charges that your committee in 2009 wisely gave to the Law Commission was in restructuring the inheritance tax, do it in such a way that it is substantially revenue neutral. That has, my point about that when we had the conversation, you may recall, was that if, for instance, if the legislature wanted to abolish the inheritance tax, you don't need a work group to do that. That's just a vote to abolish the inheritance tax. And I didn't particularly want to be assigned the task of creating a revenue-raising measure. What we're creating is a structure, and you can move that structure around. You can move rates within that structure to accomplish what you want. But what we intend to present to you is, in gross, a substantially revenue-neutral concept, focusing more on the mechanics and the workings of the estate tax than particular revenue issues, either up or down. So that was a good thing to have in the way of parameters around the work that we have done over this past couple of years. Another thing, and Mazen touched on it too, we are currently tied in Oregon for our inheritance tax to the federal estate tax law as it existed pre-EGTRA. That's the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act of 2001. And Mazen also mentioned that we don't have tax rates in our statutes. You have to know, you have to go back to those pre-EGTRA federal schedules and use those schedules to determine your tax computation. That was becoming difficult just because of the passage of time and remoteness of that. It makes even less sense now with Congress having acted last December to reinstate the federal estate tax law. We have now a federal code, and I think it's imperative that Oregon redo what we're doing here in adopting an updated inheritance tax code, estate tax code, bring it in line with current federal law, much the way we have in the income tax, which is the way we've fashioned this, where we connect to the federal law for definitional purposes, largely, so we don't have to create a whole code. But then within that context of that connection to the federal code, then we have our own standalone Oregon estate tax system that you can open up the Oregon Revised Statutes and see. You can see what the rates are. It's something that I said once I wanted fifth graders to be able to apply. It may take middle schoolers by the time we get done, but it will be substantially more transparent than what we have today. Anything else, Wendy, in the way of just opening comments that I should set? What I'd like to do...
Representative Berger.
I think that the fifth grader you're talking about is your own son. Perhaps not the average fifth grader.
That's very good. I'll tell him.
Well, and we have been accused of being the wonk. That would require a very wonkish fifth grader to do this.
His son is not a fifth grader, but he's pretty wonk.
I would wear that with pride. Two things that I think probably I want to touch on a couple of the most important structural issues that we address in this code. Currently, Oregon has a $1 million exemption amount. If you turn in your packet to a page that looks like this, it shows you, first of all, what states have an estate tax, yes. And the states that do, it tells you what their exemption amounts are. So you can see where we stand. As you may know, the federal exemption amount now is $5 million as of last year. They finally landed on something, so we have a federal estate tax with a $5 million exemption. We are at $1 million. That's a point of reference for the discussion this morning. The other point of reference is that it's an odd way that it works. The tax up to $1 million, that is, there is no tax up to $1 million. You have an exemption from any tax. But once you cross that $1 million threshold, that on that first dollar over $1 million, you don't begin to pay tax at that point. Once you cross that $1 million threshold, you pay tax back to the first dollar of the estate. So the effect is, on an estate just below $1 million, the tax is zero. You get to $1,000,001, and the tax is about $33,000. So in the span of a couple of dollars there, you go from zero to $33,000. That's a structural issue, and it just doesn't make sense. So we adopted early on the concept of more of a ramp up, so that once you reach that taxable threshold, you begin to pay, but you begin to pay at lower rates, and the amount of tax increases with the increase in the value of the estate. So there is that a ramp instead of that big step at that first dollar over $1 million. The other thing that I'll show you the graphs that illustrate how this works. The other thing that we did, and this is a policy call that our work group made, and I'll tell you that you can work with this. But if you look at the list of states that have an estate tax and the states that don't, if you map that out, you will see that Oregon and Washington are really an island of states in the western United States that even have an estate tax. California does not, Arizona does not, Utah, Idaho, Nevada, all around us, we are surrounded by states that don't have this at all. Washington has a $2 million exemption amount. We're at $1 million. We had practitioners in our work group who said that it is not uncommon in Portland for estate planners, when you have a married couple with a potentially taxable estate, to mention to them that one estate tax strategy is to relocate across the river, and thereby exempting another $2 million from their estate between the couples. And we were concerned that there may be a competitive disadvantage. It's hard to quantify, but it's certainly there. Where Oregon has a $1 million threshold, Washington has a $2 million threshold. That's $1 million difference for an individual. For a couple, that's a $2 million difference, and that begins to add up in terms of potential tax savings. We looked at the prospect of raising our exemption amount to a level closer to that of Washington, to reduce that anti-competitive posture of our tax. And if you look on the pages immediately after this page, you see sort of the first cut that we made in evaluating how we would want to structure this. The very first chart, it has a number one on it at the bottom of the page. It says revenue neutral at $1 million exemption, Washington structure, and a ramp up. So that says let's get out from this issue where we have this big step at $1 million, and let's create a ramp. We'll leave the exemption amount at $1 million, and then we will ramp it up like Washington's. What would that look like, revenue neutral? And so you see in the bar graph there, tax liability and the tax rates, where you begin that ramp at $1 million. So we maintain here in this scenario a $1 million exemption and then just the ramp up. So we don't change the exemption, but we do change the structure of the tax above $1 million. If you go to the next slide, the next page, that illustrates the same structure, but at a $1.5 million exemption. So we don't go all the way to the $2 million exemption that Washington has, but we do increase ours by $500,000. So you have a $1.5 million exemption, and then you begin paying on that ramp. And if you look at the rates in the chart at the top, what you see there is that you go from 8.6 in Oregon at the lowest rate, 8.5 in Washington, so there's a good degree of equity between those two in terms of rates. And then at the top end, we're at 19.2, Washington's at 19, and that's pretty close too. So that although it represents an increase in tax on the upper end of estates in order basically to pay for the revenue loss
at the lower end, when you exempt that extra number of estates that fall between $1 million and $1.5 million, at least in terms of structure, this is a competitive structure with Washington in terms of rates. And it reduces that exemption amount difference to something we think is more manageable. If you look at the next one, and I'll just spend a second on that, that is the same idea, but now we say, let's start at $2 million. Let's create a $2 million exemption. And again, maintaining revenue neutrality, if we exclude tax entirely from estates below $2 million and then begin the ramp, what happens? As you can see, if you look at the chart of tax rates above the graph, what alarmed us there is that in order to maintain revenue neutrality, you get substantially out of balance, out of line with the Washington rates that you're taxing at the upper end. You jump into the 20s, 20% range, just around $6 million, where Washington is around 16% there, and you end up topping out at 24.2%, which is substantially greater than Washington's 19. Because of this...
Representative Berger?
Before you get too much further on this Washington thing...
Yeah.
Sorry, I hate to interrupt. Huh? One of the problems with measuring against... a neighboring state is, are they proposing changing their tax structure around this? I mean, we could get all lined up here and they do something that...
I'm not, Madam Chair, I'm a co-chair, I'm not aware that they are.
Representative Berger, co-chair Barnhart, in looking at this, Washington recently fixed theirs to have their own structure as well.
Yeah.
I know during the last session in Washington, they were considering raising it even higher, but that didn't go anywhere. So who knows how often they'll change theirs. But the work group concluded that raising our rates a little made it allowable to get rid of that first $1.5 million, and that's a large chunk of the estates, frankly, in Oregon. And those same estates are the ones who take the natural resource credit and all those complicated parts of it. And so it allowed a large number of estates to just not have to deal with the estate tax at all, to raise the rates a little for everyone.
So, if I could follow up, so it wasn't just around Washington.
Right.
There were other, and Washington has recently looked at this.
That's
so
right.
That, yeah, okay. That, I'm sure.
Yeah, thank you.
We must lose a lot of estates. They just simply don't have to pay a tax when we go from $1 million to $1.5 million. Is that something that may be part of your presentation?
Yeah, Mazen, do you? It's where is it?
The church.
Okay,
before.
Just before that. Yeah, if you look. And I just want to respond, if I may, just quickly to Representative Burgers. We're not in this, and I don't mean to overstress the comparison to Washington. We were looking mostly at structure, first of all, the ramp as opposed to the step. And then, of course, Washington really is our only state in the neighborhood with an estate tax. And so we thought it was useful to look at them for comparison. Wendy is right. There were considerations other than that in terms of how we structured this. If you turn forward... in the research report. Mazen, do you want to help with this real quickly?
Sure.
These are your numbers. I'm looking here, Mr. Chair, at what is, it's, it looks like this. And,
right.
Okay.
And this is, and what this.
Forward of the charts that we were just looking at.
This is, you would probably also find it in your basic facts. What this is, giving you a distribution of the different estates with value. So if you look at the different years, and the years we used are the 5, 6, and 7. But if you look at any of them, and you look at the 1.5 million up to 2 million, you would see that this is probably making up about 14% to 15% of the total estates, the total...
It looks like more like a third.
The value is...
Right. The value is about 15%, and the number... So
yep.
the first column would give you the number, how many in each of those categories. That's the percentage. The second one would be giving you the percentage of how many of those that make up the total of the numbers and by volume. And then the third column is the amount of tax, and the last and the fourth column is the percentage of the tax paid by that group out of the total. So the percentage out of paid by the 1.5 to 2 million is about 15 to 16%, which explains why you have this quick departure from the rates of between, you know, what the group was looking for to a much higher number.
A couple things about that, if I may, Mr. Chair. Number one, this is where I can tell you you can tweak this how you want. Where the task force, the commission will come to you with the recommendation of the $1.5 million exemption and then the ramp. The effect of that, of course, is to excuse this number of states from estate tax entirely. The trade-off on that is that you are going to higher rates on the upper end. To us, that makes sense. And that's where we did look at Washington to make sure that we don't put ourselves in an anti-competitive posture with our neighboring state on their rates. But just in the interest of full disclosure, that is how you pay for excusing those estates that are now falling between the million and a million and a half. You pay for that and maintain rough revenue neutrality by increasing rates at the top end, but still within the parameters of our only neighboring state that has any tax at all. If you decided that we don't want to raise those rates on the top end, that becomes difficult to do. You don't have to, and it's not a major insult to the bill. You can simply say that we're going to leave the $1 million exemption amount. We'll start there, and that flattens the ramp going up. And so this is a place where we're giving you a structure that has in its place that $1.5 million exemption with the corresponding adjustment in rates on the top end, revenue neutral in total. But if you say, you know, that's just difficult to do and you want to maintain the $1 million exemption, you can do that. And the structure still works.
Can I make a comment?
Yes.
Members of the committee, another point is that at the federal level, you don't owe a tax until $5 million. Right. And when you do, any estate tax that you paid, you do get a credit for what you paid. And it used to be the pickup tax, it was a dollar for a dollar you got back on your federal return. That pickup is gone, but you still do get almost a 50 cents on the dollar credit. So even though the top rate is 19%, you would get that money back on your federal return. So those who are over $5 million will get that credit. Those who are under $5 million have no federal estate tax due, so they're not getting that benefit. So it does make that cost shift up more palatable, because it really, on the bottom dollar, it's not costing them that amount.
And if I may follow up on that, and this is Mazin's chart that he passed out this morning, the point about that is important, because at about $5 million is where an Oregon estate would begin to pay more under this structure than under the current structure. That's where you begin to see the makeup on the top end. So that is where, at that $5 million level, is also where estates begin to pay federal estate tax, and so we'll be able to use the credit amount against their federal estate tax to offset the increase in the state estate tax. So there is a connection there between what we are doing and what Congress has done that will offset that additional tax liability. Because again, on this chart, you see that over that $5 million range is where the Oregon estate tax under this proposal starts to creep up above current law.
And
so the feds help our estates pay that.
So, Mazin, the new one is the column to the right.
Correct.
In our copy, we can't see that.
Well, Mr. Yeah. Chair, I have to apologize for this. Because that's the price of sending print jobs through VPN while you're working at home.
Yeah.
You don't know how it turns out to be until you come and print it in the morning. And that's the best way to describe it. That is the right column, or the right set of columns, would be the new structure as proposed by the bill. The left one is current. And as you would see, at the 1.6 million, you would have this very tiny, small thing that is trying to come out. But it's not succeeding.
Now these are dollars.
Could
you develop another chart showing the effect of the federal tax credit on the real effect of the federal tax credit that we're learning about now? I didn't know that credit existed until just a minute ago.
Well, we could give it a shot.
You would, in order to derive that, you'd have to figure out how many above the 5 million would be projected,
mm-hmm.
and then how much credit they would get under a proposal. So it would be basically a sort of a good guess.
Right.
Well, it would be an average of what we have and what we based our things on. Of course, now, since that we developed the average on the 5, 6, and 7, or 2005, 6, and 7, we have more developed data of 2008 now.
And another thing that would be interesting to know was whether the credit applies against the tax that's paid on the portion below 5 million in Oregon, whether the federal credit is applied against that. And that depends on how the thing is worded in the Internal Revenue Code. So,
Mr. Chair, I think it does. I think it applies to all state estate tax paid.
So people just above 5 million will get quite a reduction in their federal tax because that the portion before 5 million they'll get a credit for half of. So that's an issue as well, it seems to me. I mean, I think it's important if we took this to the floor,
mm-hmm.
for the members to be able to get a graphic image of what the actual effect is in terms of the overall estate taxes that Oregonians pay.
And Mr. Chair, I think it would be interesting. I'll bet Mazin could do that, a chart that basically nets out the effect of the federal credit on this, so that you're not just looking at the Oregon tax, but if you, of course, an estate pays ultimately a tax bill. Part of it goes to the state, and some of it may go to the Fed. It's all tax. So the question is, what's the netting out in terms of the impact of what we're proposing here of the Oregon change? That'd be an interesting question, and I'll bet Mazin could do that.
Oh, sure he can. Yeah.
I'd request you not do it at home so that the chart...
Yeah.
don't print the chart till you get back to the office.
Right. Mr. Chair, that is, in terms of, you know, the big structural issue, those are the two things that we will be coming to you with. One is the ramp as opposed to the big step. And secondly, based on our own call, $1.5 million threshold that will exempt those estates now that are subject to tax between $1 million and $1.5 million, those go away. It will lower the rates because of the ramp effect on estates at the beginning level of taxability, but then as you get up into the upper range over that $5 or $6 million, you will see an increase in the Oregon inheritance tax, which then will be offset by the credit allowable to those estates under the federal estate tax. So that is really, in summary, the structure of the tax that we are bringing to you. And again, as I say, the structure will work no matter where you put those numbers. But we think that range makes the most sense, and so are going to be recommending that to you. Something else just about it. We believe, and we have no way to know, but we believe that there's a good bit of leakage out of the system. In terms of compliance, as we have today. We believe that estates that are larger are probably more likely to be compliant because they've got lawyers and accountants who are sophisticated to work with the clients and know that you need to pay this this tax. We think that there is very likely a number of estates in that $1 million to $1.5 million range that probably are not even filing today, that we're not even collecting. And so in some respects, there may be a bow toward compliance with this too by creating this threshold and just saying you people don't have to pay under $1.5 million. And we're going to focus on these estates that have really the larger amounts and probably the more sophisticated planning and the ones that we're going to be more likely to be able to collect from. That was just the sense from the people in the room that in that range of estates between $1 million and $1.5 million, there are probably a number, and I don't want to say a substantial number, but probably a measurable number that just don't file. And we don't have any way to track that, to identify those non-filers. So there isn't a system in place to do that. And so we hope that by raising this and focusing on these estates, will actually increase compliance as well.
I'd just like to add to that. In the packet, the number 29 recommendation provides that we do recommend adding more resources to the Department of Revenue for compliance. When we had the pickup tax and it was just passing through to the states, obviously the auditing that the feds would do would take care of Oregon because it was the same. That's not the case anymore, and so the department has not had the resources to look at these estates that are in the gap that's between the federal threshold and Oregon. So now it's $1 million and $5 million is the difference. So all those estates between $1 million and $5 million, there is no federal auditing of those estates. And so by bumping it up to 1.5, we lose a large chunk, another big chunk of estates that we don't have the resources already to audit. And so we do recommend increasing those audit allowances because we still have a gap between $1.5 million and $5 million. We all know that revenue streams are important, but if you don't have the right compliance structures to do the auditing, there is that leakage potential.
And Mr. Chair, you have the report in front of you, and I think most of what we have done has been, apart from that call that I just described to you, the $1.5 million and the ramp, and then the rates that will maintain revenue neutrality. A lot of what we have done has been wonkish and technical, just in terms of cleaning up existing law and, frankly, filling gaps. I think those of us who practice a little bit in this area were shocked as we've spent the last couple of years going line by line through the code.
Representative Vance?
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, it's okay.
It pains me to suggest this, but there should be techniques that would allow the department to determine if folks have appropriately filed. I mean, I can think of one almost immediately, but have you debated this issue? Because I don't really see how this, unless I just wonder what your additional folks are going to look for, given the nature. We don't probate many estates anymore.
That's right.
So what are you going to look for?
Deborah?
We have
for historical purposes, Mr. Chair, the Representative Vance is right. When we used to have our own inheritance tax, and most people probated estates of any size, you had to get an inheritance tax release from the Department of Revenue before you could close the estate. That went away with the change to the pickup tax when we just took the federal estate, the tax credit available to the federal estate, and it has not been reinstated. And frankly, probably doesn't make much sense to reinstate today since you have so many estates passing not through probate but through trusts and other mechanisms. Now, probate has become much less common than it was. So, Deborah?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Never having been an estate tax auditor, I don't have all of the list of things that we would look at, Representative Vance. But I think probably for us the issue now is resource in the unit. We have two tax auditors who review and process the returns. We also have a manual process. It's not computerized to process those returns. So I'm sure they have tools that they could use to identify the estates. The question is, do they have the time to be able to do that in addition to process the returns that do come in and examine those for accuracy?
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
So I'm still a little at a loss to know what those tools might be. And I'm just interested because I've heard exactly what Lane has suggested many times, given the lack of oversight. And so I'm just curious what the department would tell the practitioners they should be worried about so they could advise their clients that the proper thing to do is file.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, under current processes, we have an indicator on the individual income tax return that asks whether this is the final return for a person. If that's checked, we could simply take that information and follow up to see whether or not an inheritance tax return needs to be filed and whether one has been filed. We could look at public records such as property tax records that show a transfer of property, death notices that appear in the paper, for example, or I believe we have access to the vital records information and could review that. So there, you're absolutely correct. There are resources available to ensure compliance. It's simply finding the time to use those tools with the staff that we now have. And if I may, the chair, Chair Shatterly mentioned the inheritance tax that we used to have. My research indicates that we had about 12 staff in the unit at that time, and that's when we did have a completely separate inheritance tax with no connection to the federal law. The structure we have now builds on the federal law, so we can use that, but it's just a matter of staff and time.
Thank you.
Yeah, and Representative Vance, Mr. Chair, it is of concern. We didn't spend a lot of time on the compliance side other than recognizing that the more transparent the system we create, the easier it will be to comply with, and the more likely we'll have that compliance. And as resources become available, the easier it will be to monitor compliance. But as you know, unlike the income tax system, you know, you don't have 1099s and those kinds of things that get kicked out in the case of a transfer of wealth on death. And this is a much more a system of voluntary compliance just by the nature of the beast. And so our effort in at least trying not to make things worse, but to make things better, it was that if we could make a system that was more understandable, perhaps not at the middle school level, but still more understandable, that would make compliance easier, and as resources are available to the department, would make monitoring compliance easier as well, we thought. The other thing I think that I would touch on just for a little bit this morning excuse me, is the natural resource property. That continues to be the one piece of this that we are still putting together in final form. I announced last meeting that our last final meeting will be coming up here in the next couple of weeks, where we will conclude this. But on page 5 of my report are the points that about the natural resources property issue that we're dealing with, most of which we have decided. There are a couple of things we are still struggling with. The big issue in the natural resources is while we want to maintain revenue neutrality in the large picture, we also want to maintain relative revenue neutrality with respect to natural resources. That is, we don't want to make the natural resources property tax credit bigger. We're not focusing on making it smaller, but relative to the tax burden, we're trying to devise a natural resources credit that now will work within this new system and maintain relative neutrality as compared to the totality of that system. A couple of things, excuse me, that we've done that are structural. If you look down at bullet point number 21, we are maintaining the $15 million maximum. That is, in order to qualify for the natural resources credit, the gross estate may not exceed $15 million. half of the gross estate has to be natural resource property. Yeah, that's in present law. Uh-huh. And the third point is something new that will be coming from us, that for farm or forestry businesses, 25% of the natural resource property must be real property. This may come as a surprise to you, but under current law, the natural resources tax credit does not require that the estate claiming the credit own any real property, since it applies to equipment. Somebody who owns a farm implement retail business. That is, equipment used in the operation of a farm could potentially qualify for the natural resources tax credit because in their inventory they have a lot of tractors and combines. We think that probably was not the intention of the legislature, since the discussion was all about family farms and those kinds of things. And so we are actually proposing to include a qualifier that at least 25% of the natural resource property must be real property, so that equipment is fine, but it has to be tied to something in the estate that is actually on the ground.
And that requirement is the same at the federal...
That's right.
...for that federal election that is available, so that 25% is consistent.
Yeah, that ties to federal law.
This doesn't apply to fishing boats, I
think. No, it does not. That's right. That is for farm or forestry business. We're still trying to find someone that has claimed this for fishing, but...
hasn't happened yet. You know, we worked this bill twice in two different sessions, and we completely missed that point.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much we continue to miss, given what we're trying to aim at.
Yeah.
Aim and miss...
Yeah, so, Mr. Chair, we are helping you with that, we think. And again, from the practitioners, that made a lot of sense because it is the same as what the federal law requires, and so it connects very well to that. And it really does make sure that the credit is being directed to the estates that we think the legislature intended to allow. The other thing that we're doing is up on in point 18. When I say that 50% of the gross estate must be natural resource property, we are working with the definition or work with what you've called in current law working capital, which it became devilishly difficult, and you know that from the work that you did on it. And so, and I explained this in one of my earlier status reports to you during the interim, but what we have gone with instead is simply an operating allowance. Within the definition of natural resource property, so that operating allowance can count toward the 50% threshold in order to qualify the estate for the natural resource credit. And that operating allowance would be limited to its cash and cash equivalents at the lesser of 20% of the other natural resource property. So you can't have 95% cash and 5% in real estate and call that your natural resource credit. So it's limited to the lesser of 20% of the other natural resource property. That would be land and equipment, those kinds of things, for which a credit is made, or $1.5 million, which is 20% of $6 million, and I won't take you through that today. But so there is a cap on what you can claim in the way of operating allowance. 20% of the other natural resource property. Okay, $6 million is $7.5 million what you have today minus 1.5, which is the exemption that everybody gets. So we're working with those numbers. That's how we're trying to make the credit fit within this new structure. So the benefit to that is it doesn't take an audit of every estate claiming the working capital credit, working capital as part of the credit to prove their working capital. 20%, I think I answered, might have been Senator Burdick's question at the joint meeting, is really not a technical number. It's one that seems to work in the work group and recognizes that different natural resource business operations, farms and forestry operations, are going to have hugely different working capital at different points. Well, the different businesses will have different working capital given the nature of the business, and the same business, one business, will have different amounts of working capital depending on where they are in the cycle of crops, of trees on the ground, those kinds of things. And so rather than try to make a credit here that would have to be tailored specifically for every estate, we think that maintaining an operating allowance within these limits is a fair way to do it. I will say that we think that we will not see people abusing this to claim the credit, in part because if you use operating allowance to claim the credit, then that operating allowance is subject to the same limitations on transfer and disposition as any other natural resource property. And so you can't use cash to claim the credit, and then after you claim the credit, distribute it to the grandkids and say, here's your money. You've got to hold that cash and make it available and use it in the operation of the farm. And this is an area where we actually are proposing a built-in compliance method where the estate, the heirs of the estate claiming the credit, we're proposing will file annually reports to the Department of Revenue, which would show the maintenance of that natural resource property, both the real estate equipment and operating allowance. They will have to file every year for until they have qualified for their 5 years after death use of the property. So the department will see if there have been transfers out of the property that would trigger some recapture of that. So there is a case where we actually are going forward building a very specific compliance structure into this.
And for those following along, that's number 25 on the list of recommendations.
25.
And, Mr. Chair, I think, you know, again, we've had plenty of opportunities to converse about this during the interim. I think I'll stop there and maybe ask Wendy if she has any wrap-up comments for me, and then we'll be happy to answer questions. Just to tell you, we do have, I anticipate, one more meeting in which we will finish up these very last issues, and then we'll come back to you with a an LC that would replace House Bill 2541, and I believe that that LC will look very much like what you see in this report and what I've described to you today, but it will finalize some of the issues on that natural resource tax credit. Part of what we're struggling with is where Mazin is going to have to help us. What formula do you use in granting the allowance of this credit? And with the new structure, the $1.5 million exemption and the ramp and the change of rates in there, how do we maintain some sort of revenue neutrality? That's Mazin's assignment, to come up with a formula that estates can apply to calculate this natural resource tax credit. And I think once we have that, we're just about good to go.
Commissioners, one other point I'd like to make that is verging on wonkishness, but it's important, is that the elections that you make on the federal return and those you make on the state return, this bill would recommend that those are separate elections. Yeah. And also those natural resource credit elections that you make and the special Oregon marital elections that you make, those also can both be made. Those overlap issues were surprising to some as they did their return, and you couldn't make both elections, or you couldn't make different elections, or you couldn't make both the Oregon natural resource and the marital, and everyone's treated the same way that you can make both elections, but that's not a conflict. And so that's point 17 and point 11 in the packet, that those are separate elections, federal and state, and you can make both Oregon elections, but they don't conflict.
That is wonkish.
Well, as long as our tax laws are separate,
right,
and they're not connected,
right,
and we have considerations that are different, right, from the ones the feds are dealing with, I'm assuming that that's part of what led you to the conclusion that they ought to be separate.
Mr. Chair, that is exactly right. I think there was easy agreement that they should be. I think it was less clear whether they are.
Right.
Yeah, and so we're being explicit about that you can make separate elections on your Oregon return. You're not excluded, or you're not bound by any elections that you made on the federal return. And again, that we think that's the way it should be. It's not entirely clear that's the way it is, but this law will clarify that.
And this may be a question for the department. Do we get copies of the federal returns? We do. Okay. I'm getting three head nods, so yeah, all right.
Where, Mr. Chair, where you wouldn't, especially now going forward, would be in an Oregon estate of $2 million.
Because there is no return.
Yeah.
You've raised some very interesting compliance issues, and taking it back to your leader, another set of resource issues, it seems to me. Other questions? Yes, Representative Wand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is outside of the scope of what you were talking about, but the concern that I've always had about the concept of an inheritance tax, in addition to the family farm, which is already well covered by other people a lot smarter than me, is the extent to which somebody who dies unexpectedly and tragically gets hit disproportionately to someone who doesn't die unexpectedly and tragically. And at the risk of taking my fellow lawyers that practice in this area of the law and throwing them out of the bus, isn't it the case that if you have time to plan, you can protect your wealth to a much greater extent than if you don't have time to plan? And how have you guys mulled that over in your process? Is that something that we can correct for, or is that just a life circumstance that we can't fix?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wand, yeah, in part, we think we're helping make that easier for people by raising the exemption to the 1.5, so that, you know, for most people, this is not ever going to be an issue. Above that, frankly, no, I don't think we've changed that. I guess it's a given and probably accepted fact that in all areas of tax, whether it be income or business tax or in this case estate, planning with people who know the system will probably save you money. And short of creating a system that doesn't have credits and deductions and exemptions, but treats everybody the same and doesn't allow basically for planning, I don't know how we would get there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wand, we did talk a little bit about how those on the top end of the chart, their estate doesn't really represent what their real estate is because they have done planning and made transfers ahead of time. And so, again, while those rates at the top end are the highest rates, those estates are most likely larger, and it's the ones on the bottom end of the scale that those their estate that is on the return is really more likely to be their real estate. And so we did talk a bit about that issue, but there's really nothing you can do to plan after the death. I mean, there's not a way we can really fix it. The marital deduction or the marital, you know, spousal issue, that helps in the unexpected situation, but for the run-of-the-mill person who didn't plan and has that tragedy, there really is not a way to fix the law ahead of time.
And I would say, too, I did mention that we're making life or death easier for the people, again, the smaller estates are the one less likely to plan. And so by excluding the estates up to $1.5 million, we think we're addressing that. And then keep in mind, based on the rate structure that we proposed with $1.5 million and the ramp, even for those estates between $1.5 million and up to $5 or $6 million, we are reducing the tax liability here. So even for those estates, they will pay less tax under this proposal. For those above, they will pay more, but they're the estates that, because of the degree of sophistication, that you know that they're planning and can do that. So it's not a perfect answer, but I think it gets at least it recognizes the issue.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first, for purposes of delving into definitions, can you address just briefly the difference and why we use a credit rather than a deduction for the, just extremely briefly, just very.
Then the answer is no.
Madison might be able to.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair and Representative Benz, actually, because if you may recall from my interim reports, we looked at going to a deduction for the natural resources property. And I still remember the meeting in LRO's office last December or so, when Manson threw up the charts on the wall and showed the differences between the credit and the deduction. And basically, Manson, you can describe it. It has substantial revenue impacts to go deduction as opposed to credit. Without making even more fundamental changes, and which is where we ended up saying we'll go back to credit and we'll just deal with cleaning a credit up. But Mazen, if you want to...
Well, and before he does, let me just say we started with a deduction. and went to the credit because we realized that it wasn't working. Madison, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dents and members of the committee, one of the things that you could see as this not very clear chart and graph in front of you that I put with proposed and current law, what this is, the difference that we have proposed from current law works almost in the same way. The current law has $1 million exemption. An exemption in the sense that you exempt the first million and then you resume your tax schedule after the million. The proposed law, as you would see it in the back, and this is probably Elaine did not emphasize this, but the committee or the task force wanted a lot tighter schedule. So if you see this, they don't necessarily go as the old 1 million and million and a half. They actually wanted something a lot briefer. So this is the thing that you would see in the bill is a lot more compact, and that's the way we do it. But this thing does is tells the taxpayer or the estate or the inheritance is take the first $1.5 million and take it away of the consideration. This is completely out of consideration. And as you would see from the graph behind, all what you started with from 1 million to about 1.5, this goes out of the whole process. Now, if you go to the same type of exclusion to the natural resource credit, you can do that. However, you're not going to be able to go with a $7.5 million, because what you do is you will bring about all the top rate payers and bring them down all the way to a much lower schedule of pay. So you basically have taken away all the top payers and reduced all their payment amounts significantly in order to make it an exclusion. And that's what started happening with the credit. So you could go to an exclusion, but you're not going to be at $7.5 million. What you could do is an additional probably $1 million, $1.5 million in top of the $1.5 million that you have. So in total, you would be able to exclude about $3 million. But that probably was not what the committee with the simplification idea was trying to get to. Remember, there was an overwhelming drive to simplify with the process. So that's why we had the tighter schedule. Then the issue became also that we do want to go into a credit. If that's the case, so let's go to a credit. But the credit, we don't want it to be a credit schedule as we have it in current law. So let's find a formula that applies the same type of credit in the same way to the new schedule, which has an exclusion rather than an exemption, but use a formula for it rather than a credit schedule. Now, we found a formula at one point that approximately works for the old schedule, but we haven't found the one that works for the new schedule. And that's I guess, the idea that we're trying to go. It's like in math, you would go from one number system, from the number the real number system to the hexadecimal type of number system. So you're moving from one universe to another, and in that sense, you need some help with that. I hope that hexadecimal kind of thing just worked fine for you.
Let me follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
We've established the wonkish element. I assume that in paragraph 18, where we see the word still being revised, that's what you're referring to, Mazin.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to that because I still recall 3 years ago when this conversation started, the confusion that arises over this area. And it's it's extraordinarily interesting in application and the differences. So I'm looking forward to the conversation of the. I'm looking forward to the revision when it comes along, and I really would appreciate a very clear explanation of how the two match up, because there's a lot of activity in those few words.
Actually, there is, Representative Vince. And as you remember from the time of the 2008, when the idea was started with an exclusion, let's go with the 7.5 million, or that. The intent of the 2007 legislation was not clear whether it was an exclusion or not.
That's
and then when we started looking at how the exclusion works and how much it costs versus how much that was intended at the time we did it, the exclusion at that time was known and found to be a lot more expensive than the intent of the 2007 legislation. So it was by several times, and that's why we went to the credit to come closer to where that price tag, if you will, was. So there is that movement, and unfortunately, three different parts are moving in the same time. And if you're willing to bear with it, I'm willing to bring a PowerPoint presentation that shows that movement between the things next time, so we could look at it and see how the exclusion still is expensive, in the sense that you can't go with that not much exclusion to the old or new, but you need the credit because you're trying to
yeah.
achieve right. or hit a bullseye, if you will.
Yes, please.
I'm not sure whether the co-chairs will allow that presentation, but I would very much enjoy seeing it. I'm not fooling. I understand the intersection of policy and math. And it's not a pretty sight. I would like to see it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vince, if I may, yeah, Mazin does have a PowerPoint on that, and I think when we come back and talk about the natural resource, that'd be an appropriate time to show. And what it persuaded us was that indeed, to maintain revenue neutrality in gross and in particular within the credit. We would have had to reduce the maximum amount substantially, and while we would make the argument that it's the appropriate natural resource tax credit within this new structure, frankly, it would look and work a lot different than the current, and I think would probably raise angst among those groups that are the strongest partisans of the natural resource tax credit. And so because of that potential revenue impact, and also the sense that as much as possible we wanted a credit that looked like the credit that we have today, that people have developed some familiarity with, we stayed with the credit, we stayed with that $15 million cap, the $7.5 million, those numbers are all there. What will be different will be, as Mazin says, not a credit schedule now, but a formula that will capture the amount of credit on a per estate basis, and that formula really is the nut of what we are waiting yet to finish. Then I think it'd be entirely worthwhile to bring you the whole discussion back and walk you through our progression of how we started with moving to a deduction, moved back from that, and then ended up with this formula.
Thank you. And, you know, it occurs to me as we talk about this that we started out with this process around the natural resources property, trying to figure out how we would manage the issues of liquidity and the desire of small farmers to pass on their businesses to their natural heirs. And the more, as we get into these more detailed areas of discussion, we have to, I think it's really important that we not lose sight of that was what our goal was. It occurs to me, too, that with the new federal law that is now in place, we have, I don't know, frankly, whether we have time this session or not, because with all the things we have to do, but at some point, it would be very useful to take another look at the way in which this natural resource credit fits in with the overall tax impacts on these kinds of businesses, not just the Oregon estate tax, but also the federal one. And with the change in the exempt amount at the federal level, what effect does that have, if any, on these issues? I frankly don't want to reopen the whole thing this session because I don't think we have time. But on the other hand, we don't want to lose track either of what we were trying to accomplish in the first place. I'm not sure which way that cuts for us today. The other thing is I would hate to lose the really great work of the commission on all the other aspects because we got stuck on this one. I suspect, given that this natural resource issue only really came up in 2007, and in our hubris we thought we could manage it, that it isn't done. And even the passage of this bill, it won't be finished. I don't think we're finished with the issue.
Yeah.
Anything? Chair, yes, please.
I just wanted to build on your remarks about the work you guys have done. This is really great.
I mean, it is a wonderful piece.
Yeah, and so I just wanted to say that. Thank you for all your work.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, of course, one of the most productive participants in our group has been, I think it's your cousin, Clint. It's been a real pleasure to work with him. He's a CPA here in Salem?
Yes.
Yeah, and it's been a real pleasure to. These work groups that we assemble for the commission are always fun because we get brilliant people, and I get to spend time in the room with them. And this has been no exception. We got tax practitioners and estate planning practitioners and accountants, and we do have a former auditor, an inheritance tax auditor from the department, who's been a member of the work group. Excellent work group.
Mr. Chair, if
yes,
I may.
Please.
There's some welcome confusion over our names, my cousin's name, and I welcome the confusion that he doesn't.
Maybe a professional decision. Yeah, if I could take full credit for giving this to the Law Commission,
please do.
I will.
Yes.
There are times in this process where you have a good idea, and boy, you're glad you did.
Yes.
This has been stellar work. I know you're not finished, and thank you for not punting, too,
yeah.
Because right
yeah.
now we're,
That's
you
right.
know, in that fire hose
yep.
mode where there's just way too much. I did want to comment, Mr. Chair, on your questions and the discussion around compliance. I know it's an important issue, and it's an issue that you've personally been concerned with, and I am not unmindful of it. But I would suggest that while we leave it, you know, out there as something we talk about, I think job one is to get this set of statutes in some sort of order where we can ask compliance because it's at least comprehensible.
Yeah.
It's hard to ask compliance on something as chaotic as what we've had. So I think that I would just encourage that step one is to get a set of statutes that people can understand before we start talking about their compliance in any real out there way.
Completely agree. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I might just follow up, I would be remiss if I left the committee with the impression that we're asking for 10 additional staff. And I do want to remind you that we are now engaged in a very intense process of examining how we operate, working through a transformation of our agency, looking for additional capacity and efficiencies, and it may be that we can find additional compliance resources within the agency with what we have when we're finished with that process. But that's going to be ongoing. It's going to take several years and a lot of work. So I did want to leave you with that. I can hear my director's voice ringing in my head to
yes.
make sure I remind you of that process yep. that's going on now.
Yep. Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, if I also might add your point about we may not be done with the natural resource property is well taken in the fact that it's only been on the books a couple years.
Yes.
And it's changed each year. And remember how volatile estate tax is anyway with only about 1,000 returns, and it really changes on who died and how large that estate was. So, and of those 1,000 estates, less than 10 a year have been natural resource property. So we have very little data to try to figure out how much impact our changes would make. Madison's done a great job of trying to figure out how that would all work out, but it's tough to know what these incentives will provide, whether people will take the credit because they then have to lock up their land and their use for 5 years, and what adjustments these make. I mean, it's really hard to predict how much it will affect the revenue stream in the end with only a couple years of data and very few people making that election.
Yes, Chair. Please.
Mr. Chair, just to add to this point, if you see in your report, the new column with tables here in this LRO report, that we do include the natural resource credit as a new type of statistic that we are looking
at. There it is.
And in the 2009, we came to about 1.2 million. The 2008 is 1.6. However, it's a bit distorted because the process, and Deborah, remind me of the one that we had to make whole the 2007.
It's a 2 year.
Right.
So basically 2 years.
So that in a way is a bit of a distortion. But the 2009, we have about 1.197. That's 1.2 million. That's approximately what the credit that we were shooting at, if you remember, in that time. We didn't want to spend that much more money. At the same time, we were willing to go with that was the price of the policy, I guess, at that time that you were looking at. And if you remember from that time, we had different prices, and you were choosing which price that would be going with. However, the natural resource property would, if the work goes away, what would I do after this?
Full employment.
Thank you. We've come to expect a humorous remark or two from Mazin, and not to be disappointed today. Let me add my comment to my co-chair's comment about the value of the work of the commission. I was thinking a few minutes ago, as my head was hurting trying to get around some of these concepts, how pleased I am that these really bright people you referred to are working on this issue. I was also reminded, as you said that, why I enjoy this committee so much, because it also is a bunch of really bright people who stretch me as I try to understand these issues and try to work with them. I personally really appreciate the work that you're doing. We look forward to the next piece and the LC draft, and we're obviously going to dedicate at least one more meeting of the committee to going through all of that. I'm going to commend this February 10th document to the members of the committee to review and read and write questions about, so that when you come back, we can, with the amendment, we can get down to those other questions. Anything else for Lane and Company this morning? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. This is a public hearing. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard this morning on House Bill 2541? Yes, ma'am. Please come forward. Anyone else while she's coming forward?
For the record, I'm Jody Weiser with Pax Furnace, Oregon, and we are a nearly all-volunteer citizens group that works to advocate for fair, stable, and adequate taxes. And I won't repeat that definition of who we are any more times this year. We have been participating in virtually all of the meetings of the Oregon Law Commission. And as you know, Peggy Bolsey is a former estate tax lawyer estate tax auditor for the Department of Revenue, and so her experience has been helpful in that committee. And we are very proud of most of the work that has come out of it. I mean, there were problems with the estate tax that I certainly was unaware of that we've, I believe, fixed. And there's so many different little pieces that we've had to struggle with which way to go and how to resolve the problem. However, we wish to present a minority vote on the idea of raising the exemption and increasing the rate. And we say this for four reasons. First, while fewer are paying, and it looks like the revenue would be neutral when you're dealing with a static set of estates of people who have already died, you can't take into account the behavioral changes that might happen because the person who's doing their estate tax planning looks down there and sees that in Oregon the rate is 19%, and in all but every other estate, the rate is 16% or less. And so I think you would be likely to see behavioral changes that the work that Mathen has done just can't take into account. And I think we should hesitate to consider that option. Second, we don't see the necessity. There's really only about 300 out of the 1,000 estates that file each year actually pay taxes. Many of those are filings for the first of two people who are going to die, or they're filings for estates that are actually valued at less than our exemption level, but they want to protect their statement that this is what our estate is valued at. And so we're really not talking about very many individual Oregon families that are dealing with paying the estate tax, and to increase the exemption level so that we can exempt a few people just doesn't seem like something that is of merit and has great necessity. Further, we don't see how this addresses the core values of the state and what our functions are. Usually you want a broader tax that has a lower rate, not a more narrow tax that has a higher rate, and this works in the opposition of where we would usually go. And finally, we doubt that the majority of Oregon voters believe that it's appropriate to grant yet another tax break to wealthy individuals at this time. There is no clamor of people behind me in this room today saying, yes, you've got to change the estate tax. You've got to make it less onerous. They're just simply not here because it isn't that big an issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Jody? Thank you very much. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on the bill this morning? I don't see anyone. With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2541. Is there anything else to come before the committee this morning? 32 minutes. Use them wisely. Committee's adjourned.